That is the sound you never want to hear. It's the sound of the warning siren going off at a nuclear power plant. When you hear that sound, it means you are in the Nuclear Hot Seat. Welcome to Nuclear Hot Seat, the weekly podcast keeping you up to date on all things anti-nuclear. My name is Libby Halevi, and I'm the producer and host of this podcast. Today, we'll be talking with Michael Marriott, the Executive Director of Nuclear Information and Resource Service, on the evacuation zone distance suggested by the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, the gamesmanship around those numbers, and what you can do to try and stop them from gaming the system. Today is Tuesday, May 29, 2012, 1 year and 81 days since the Fukushima tragedy began on March 11 of 2011, and here is the latest nuclear news. In Southern California, we are well advised to stay away from sushi because absolutely every one of bluefin tuna tested from Southern California was contaminated with Fukushima radiation. Pacific bluefin tuna migrating last year from coastal Japan to the waters off Southern California contained radioactive cesium isotopes from the Fukushima nuclear disaster, scientists reported on Monday. The tuna packaged it up and brought it across the world's largest ocean, said marine ecologist Daniel Madigan of Stanford University, who led the study team. We found that absolutely every one of them had comparable concentrations of cesium-134 and cesium-137. We were definitely surprised to see it at all, and even more surprised to see it in every one we measured. Madigan went on to explain that unlike other compounds, radioactive cesium does not quickly sink to the sea bottom, but remains dispersed in the water column from the surface to the ocean floor. Fish can swim right through it, ingesting it through their gills by taking in seawater or by eating organisms that have already taken it in. The level of radioactive cesium was 10 times higher than the amount measured in tuna off the California coast in previous years. That's still far below safe-to-eat limits set by the U.S. and Japanese governments, but those limits are set arbitrarily. They are simply numbers that have been made up and have nothing to do with our own long-term health. A reminder that Physicians for Social Responsibility has stated repeatedly that there is no safe level of exposure to radiation. Now that scientists know that bluefin tuna can transport radiation, they may also want to track the movements of other migratory species, including sea turtles, sharks, and seabirds. Dr. Gregory Yasko, the departing head of the U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission, continued to press for heightened safety regulations at a meeting of industry officials last Wednesday. Yasko said that the 2011 earthquake and tsunami that devastated Japan's Fukushima Daiichi nuclear complex was a wake-up call, hopefully for everyone, but said more work needs to be done to improve reactor safety. Safety issues that take 10, 15 years to resolve are not helpful anymore, Yasko told a news conference after speaking at an annual industry meeting held in Charlotte, North Carolina. That is an area where we need to continue to make progress and where I think the industry has work to do as well. He focused on issues that he said needed to be addressed, including investments in computer systems that could predict future problems and the need for reactor operators to use social media tools to inform the public about their operations. He said the disaster in Japan demonstrated that the industry has a lot of work to do on emergency preparedness. Meanwhile, the U.S. NRC has agreed to extend the operating license of the single-unit Pilgrim nuclear power plant in Massachusetts for a further 20 years. NRC staff requested authorization from the commission to renew the plant's license, even though some contentions by politicians and environmental groups remain under adjudication before an NRC Atomic Safety and Licensing Board. The lone dissenting vote to the approval of the Pilgrim nuclear power plant was outgoing Chairman Yasko. Canada seems to be trying to get over any lingering inferiority complex when it comes to America in the nuclear area. The Canadian Nuclear Safety Commission admitted that three nuclear reactors had accidental spills of tritium, or heavy water, which is a radioactive hydrogen beta emitter and a known mutagen and carcinogen. All three spills happened within a single month. On May 2nd, the CNSC notified the public of a leak in Quebec's Gentilly 2 reactor building, which caused measurable exposure to workers. But according to the commission, releases to the environment were well below regulatory limits. Again, remember that regulatory limits are arbitrarily set and have no relationship to the reality that, again, nuclear radiation is always a danger and there is no safe level of exposure. On May 8th, CNSC notified the public that a test of the emergency water system at the Bruce B nuclear station on Lake Huron in Ontario pumped lake water in and out of the reactor building to confirm flow rate. When the water returned to the lake, it was contaminated with tritium. But according to Bruce Power, quote, there was no environmental impact, and the tritium released was well below the derived release levels. Tell that to the fish and the plankton. Then on May 23rd, CNSC was informed by New Brunswick Power Nuclear that approximately 300 liters of tritiated water was discovered inside the Point Lepreux reactor building due to a faulty valve. According to TAPCanada.org, the Tritium Awareness Project, each tritium atom eventually disintegrates by giving off a beta particle. In living tissue, the beta particle given off causes cellular damage, which may result in cancer, malformed fetuses, or genetic damage. Hence, human exposure to tritium oxide, also known as tritiated water, does pose health risks. Moving over to Japan, radiation is all over the news. According to NHK in Japan, Fukushima radiation is still circling the globe. Japanese scientists say that radioactive substances from the nuclear power plant may have been dispersed all around the globe in approximately 40 days by the end of April. A research team led by Akira Watanabe, a Fukushima University professor and meteorologist, said the overall density of the radiation is declining but continues to rise and fall alternately in 40-day cycles. It is still in the jet stream, where it continues to be brought to Earth by random rainouts. According to Asahi in Japan, high radiation levels at reactors are preventing TEPCO from even preparing for the start of decommissioning work. There are many uncertainties that could easily derail TEPCO's timetable, according to experts quoted in the article. The plan could be delayed because clearing the structure could take more time than expected, because concrete blocks and pieces of steel frame are scattered all around in and out of the number 4 reactor pool. TEPCO will also need to secure a facility to store fuel rods from the pool. The number 1 through number 3 reactors are being cooled by makeshift cooling systems, resulting in the leakage of a large amount of highly contaminated water. High levels of radiation in the drainage are preventing the utility from preparing for the start of decommissioning work. Also, concerns for possible aftershocks or a tsunami are in the mix. If a tsunami strikes the plant when the decommissioning work is underway, the makeshift cooling system could be destroyed and, according to this report, contaminated water could leak into the sea, to which Nuclear Hot Seat would like to add that that will be the least of their and our problems. Japan's prime minister during last year's nuclear crisis told a parliamentary inquiry on Monday that the country should discard nuclear power as too dangerous, saying the Fukushima accident had pushed Japan to the brink of national collapse. Mr. Naoto Kan said that the accident had brought Japan to the brink of evacuating metropolitan Tokyo and its 30 million residents. He said the loss of the capital would have paralyzed the national government, leading to a collapse of the nation's ability to function. Many economists point to the Chernobyl disaster in 1986 as the start of the fall of the former Soviet Union. Mr. Kan said the prospect of losing Tokyo made him realize that nuclear power was just too risky, the consequences of an accident too large for Japan to accept. He said, quote, "It is impossible to ensure safety sufficiently to prevent the risk of a national collapse. Experiencing the accident convinced me that the best way to make nuclear plants safe is not to rely on them, but rather to get rid of them." Did you know that Tokyo is on a short list of 3 candidate cities to host the 2020 Olympic Games? However, the International Olympic Committee, the IOC, said that Japan's decision on whether to restart its idled nuclear power reactors could have a significant impact on its chances of hosting the event. not in the way that you may think. The IOC noted that the March 2011 earthquake and tsunami has generated a reappraisal of nuclear generation. A better understanding of Japan's long-term energy strategy is needed to fully understand the potential impact of hosting the Games in 2020, according to the IOC. If there are no unexpected findings from these investigations and the lost generating capacity is replenished, meaning the nukes are turned back on, the situation can be remedied and service levels could return to pre-tsunami levels. This would be sufficient to host the 2020 Olympic Games. Here's the question. Would the athletes even bother to show up? These are people who are so tuned in to the nuances of their body that they manipulate the nanos of their nutritional profile. Do you think that if the Olympics took place in Tokyo in 2020, that they would ignore Fukushima and show up anyway and ignore any potential risk to their bodies? The IOC also noted that while radiation levels in some parts of the affected area have not been within limits set by relevant national and international agencies, radiation levels in Tokyo are consistently within limits. I think we need to send them a link to fairwinds.com so they can listen to what Arne Gundersen has to say. By the way, the IOC is set to announce its selection for the host city of the 2020 Olympic Games in September of 2013. I have to say that the fact that they are still considering Tokyo and trying to put pressure on the international community to have them restart the nuclear reactors qualifies as the Numbnuts of the Week award. For our interview today, I put out a call to find someone to comment on a rumor that I've heard at the Nuclear Free California Summit in San Clemente this past Sunday. I'll tell you more about that gathering in a little while. But the rumor I heard had to do with the NRC and evacuation zones around nuclear reactors, and that they were not only not looking to expand the limits, they were looking to shrink them. I did land the perfect person to give us clear, accurate information. I'm talking with Michael Marriott, who is the executive director of the Nuclear Information and Resource Service. And Michael, the question is about the evacuation area that is recommended by the NRC from any nuclear accident. In Japan, they said 50 miles. Their official status is 10. And I've just heard that they may be trying to take it down to 2.5. Could you please clarify for us what the current stand of the NRC is on evacuation radius?
Well, the current regulations are a 10-mile emergency planning zone, and the utilities have to conduct exercises once every 2 years to show that they can evacuate some or part of that zone. But people should know two things. One, actual evacuation in an actual emergency might not necessarily follow that circular zone. The utilities are supposed to be able to figure out where the largest amounts of radiation would be going and evacuate in those directions certainly first. You know, maybe they would end up doing a full 10-mile radius. Maybe they wouldn't. The NRC also claims that this 10-mile zone provides enough of a foundation that they could evacuate further if that became necessary. And that zone has been in effect for, well, really since the Three Mile Island accident, some 30 years. There have been numerous efforts over the years by the nuclear industry to decrease the size of that zone. I remember back in 1985, there was an industry petition to reduce it to 2 miles. There have been various legal arguments made, one in a case I was personally involved in, where the utility argued that the reactor would be so safe that there could never be any consequences outside the plant fence, and therefore nobody outside the plant fence should have standing to participate in a legal proceeding. And, of course, you don't need to extrapolate very far to see, they were also trying to argue that there would never be an evacuation.
Of course, because radiation knows where the limits of the property is and it will stop right there. We all know that that's a scientific fact.
Yeah, exactly. They were trying to argue there would never be that much radiation escaped. So the NRC rejected that argument. In that case, it was a case NIRS brought against a proposed nuclear plant in Maryland. Anyway, so the NRC and FEMA also has jurisdiction over emergency planning issues, did put out a somewhat sneaky revision to the emergency planning regulations late last year. I think it was just before Christmas. And they have weakened the regulations to a degree. They don't need to do quite as many exercises. The exercises don't have to necessarily assume a large release of radiation. Maybe it would be a very small release or that kind of thing. And, of course, you know, people realize these exercises don't actually involve trying to move people. They're more...
Are these done as computer models where they're trying to figure it out as opposed to actually getting people, say, around San Onofre on the 405 freeway?
Right. I mean, the scenarios are certainly done on computer models, and the utilities have to, you know, be able to identify. You know, a scenario is given to them. The utility has to be able to identify, okay, you know, this particular part of the plant broke, how much radiation is going to leak out, where is that going to go, what do we do? And then they, you know, they actually physically will call various emergency people in the region, you know, the police, the fire, you know, everybody knows that the exercise is coming and that kind of thing, but they check to make sure the phone lines, that the dedicated phone lines are working and the, you know, all the different components are working. But, of course, no, they never actually try to move people because that would be in itself incredibly hazardous and set off panic. So there's a large difference between sort of this kind of scenario exercise and what would happen in real life.
So is it true that they are wanting still to shrink down the evacuation zone to 2.5 miles?
Well, I haven't seen any specific proposals to that effect. No, you know, we, Nuclear Information Resource Service, currently has a petition that was backed by 37 other organizations and has since picked up, I think, 4,500 individual co-petitioners to expand the evacuation zone. We're calling for a three-tiered zone, boosting the current 10-mile zone to 25 miles, and all the current regulations and exercises would apply to that full 25-mile area, creating a new zone from 25 to 50 miles that would be a little bit less burdensome on the utilities, but the utilities would have to identify and provide to the public annually adequate evacuation routes for people in those areas. So if there were an accident, at least people would, you know where they're supposed to go, even if it hasn't been fully tested. But, you know, they'd know, well, do we go on the 405 or do we go on, you know, Route 223 or something? I mean, you know, the utility would have to plan all this out. And, of course, when you get from 25 to 50 miles, you typically have much larger populations. So it's a much trickier business. Then we're calling for an expansion of what's called the ingestion pathway zone, and that's to have state and local officials prepare for the interdiction of contaminated milk and water and food. That zone is currently 50 miles. We're calling for that to be expanded to 100 miles. And then finally, we're calling for the emergency exercises that they do, these scenarios, that at least every other one should include a regionally appropriate initiating or concurrent natural disaster. And everything in this petition is based on real-world experience. It's based on the experience of Fukushima, where there were actual evacuations carried out 25 miles and a little further away. To the northwest of the site, at Chernobyl, where the sort of circular exclusion zone was 18 miles, and villages actually as far away as a couple hundred kilometers, well over 100 miles, ended up being evacuated, although not necessarily quickly. Food contamination, water contamination of both Chernobyl and Fukushima extended, you know, well beyond the 50-mile range. In fact, in Chernobyl, certainly more than 1,000 miles. The NRC has based it, a lot of its assumptions on computer modeling, what they call a state of reactor accident consequences analysis. We think the NRC should take a closer look at what's happened in real life, should remember that the NRC itself advised Americans within 50 miles of Fukushima to evacuate, and needs to take a new look at this. And the NRC has published this petition for public comment. The comment period ends July 16th, so they're accepting public comments. You can comment from our website.
Which is NEARS.org.
NEARS.org. Go to the action page, and you can comment from there. You can also get a lot of background on the issue. Read our full petition. It's pretty long. On the nuclear 911 page of our website. Our understanding is that the NRC chose not to include emergency planning among its initial post-Fukushima safety recommendations, but that they are going to be taking another look at it in context of this petition. Since it's been published in the Federal Register, it's a legal document, they have to reply to it. They don't necessarily have to agree with it, although, of course, we hope they do, and the more comments we get in, the better off we are. But they do have to provide a substantive reply with their reasoning to it. So it is possible to use this as a mechanism to create change.
What we will do is post it on the Nuclear Hot Seat page, the website page, and I'll also put it out on the two Facebook pages that we have, so people will start the process of commenting, because the more voices we have talking to the need for safety and rationality in the even attempts at an evacuation zone, the safer we will all be in the long run, and we'll continue to bring up all the issues of danger in a way that the NRC can't ignore, so that even if they have to make comments and their reasoning is faulty, they will still be exposed as having the faulty reasoning. So at least something more will be exposed.
Well, and if the reasoning is completely inadequate, you know, there is some opportunity to go to court as well. You know, this is, you know, a legal process, so they take it seriously and we take it seriously.
Michael Maria, thank you so much for stepping forward to give us this information today. We'll stay on the story, and anything else we can do to be of service to you through Nuclear Hot Seat, just let us know.
Okay, thank you.
For our holistic tip today, it's not exactly holistic, but I think it's very important in terms of knowing new ways that technology can be used to protect our health. In Tokyo, mobile phone operator SoftBank Corp. said on Tuesday, meaning today, that it would soon begin selling smartphones with radiation detectors. The threat from the nuclear accident cannot be seen by the human eye and continues to be a concern for many people, especially for mothers with small children, said SoftBank founder and president Masayoshi Son. The smartphone in the company's Pantone series will come in 8 bright colors and will include customized IC chips that measure radiation levels in microsieverts per hour. The phone, which goes on sale this summer, can also keep track of each location a user tests for radiation levels. What a smart idea. The price has not yet been set for this, but Sun told reporters that it would be in the affordable price range. Smart capitalism. For activists, I have 2 items today. Now, I'm recording this on the 29th of May, 2012, and tonight at the Berkeley City Council in Berkeley, California, there is going to be consideration of an anti-nuclear resolution to tell Governor Brown to close California nukes. The problem is that strong opposition can be expected to the anti-nuclear resolution before the Berkeley City Council. That's because Council Member Gordon Wozniak is the Lawrence Berkeley laboratory scientist who has launched an effort to get rid of Berkeley's nuclear free zone. Not only is he likely to put up a fight, Word is that he's invited a lot of his cronies there to jam the meeting. Now, don't assume that because it's Berkeley that the resolution will pass. It's not a good sign that the item is number 46 on the agenda, which is going to come up very late in the evening, which is after many of the advocates on our side are likely to have left. It's crucial that council members and the mayor of Berkeley get flooded with emails and calls supporting a yes vote, and that they see a visible anti-nuke president with signs at the meeting. I'm putting up a link on the Facebook pages and also on nuclearhotseat.com/blog so that you can go to the site directly, and they have all the emails, all the wording you would want for Facebook, even Twitter, is there and available. So click those buttons, send them out, and let your wishes be known. Now a much happier piece of information. This past Sunday, May 27, representatives of more than 25 anti-nuclear activist and energy sustainability organizations gathered in San Clemente, California to discuss strategy and plan actions against nuclear power operations in California, as well as to promote renewable energy sources and energy-efficient solutions. The coalition, meeting for the fifth time since Fukushima, is determined to continue the fight to stop San Onofre from operating this summer and beyond, with the understanding that excess energy already exists in the state to cover our needs. Key among the issues discussed were the problems at San Onofre. It's been shut down since January 31st because of ongoing problems with their steam generators. Other safety issues include the facility having the worst safety record in the United States, being located in an active earthquake tsunami zone, lack of safe long-term storage for high-level nuclear waste, and no realistic evacuation plan. This is beyond a trifecta. A growing network of independent crowdsourced radiation monitoring by concerned citizens around the state is continuing to be implemented to counteract the ongoing lack of information provided by California utilities about radiation levels. The activists came from locations as far away as north of San Francisco down to San Diego. The network will be hosting visitors from Japan traveling throughout California to raise awareness of the ongoing Fukushima nuclear disaster. They'll be here this summer. And will continue to build alliances with national and international environmental groups. So activists are on the move, certainly here in California and elsewhere around the country. Send us an email. Let us know what's going on. Here's a final thought that I learned at the gathering, the summit this past Sunday. And I have to say, it was pretty shocking. It's about how the NRC, how the nuclear industry, is gaming the system against those of us who believe in alternative energy. You see, it's up to the NRC to define what is and is not considered to be an alternative energy. Here in California, with San Onofre down, the state is charged with coming up with replacement energy. But the rules of the game, as written and put through as law, mandate that any replacement energy must come from a single generating source. That means that alternatives, such as solar, and as we all know, there's no single generating station for solar, but a network of individual solar users, as well as 400 solar generating groups in Northern California, but none of these are allowed to connect to the grid because California Edison will not allow them. And because this energy is coming from multiple sources instead of a single source, it doesn't count as replacement energy. So the only single source for energy production available in the state are two incredibly old, dirty, recently offline gas energy generating stations in the Huntington Beach area. So what gets used? Dirty gas energy. And that's how the nuclear industry gets to claim that nukes are the only green alternative that will work. This is demented. The NRC defines what passes for an alternative and skews the language so that all our efforts with solar panels and wind and geothermal, none of it counts. Total numbnuts. Now, I received this information from Barbara George of Women's Energy Matters. We will be talking with her again in the near future about what in the world can be done to get rid of this insane roadblock to a sane, green, sustainable energy future. Before I go into the closing, I want to give you a heads up that we have a very important nuclear hot seat next week. It's on the Roy process, which is a theoretical method for knocking an electron off of a radioactive isotope to make it less radioactive or completely inert. The formula was created by physicist Dr. Rod Hal Roy and has been known about since the 1970s, but there are many reasons why information has never surfaced about this technology. So you can learn more about it on this special roundtable discussion on the Roy process for neutralizing radiation on Nuclear Hot Seat, which will be available next Tuesday, June 5th, 2012, at 4 o'clock p.m. Pacific Time. You won't want to miss it. This has been Nuclear Hot Seat for Tuesday, May 29, 2012. You can find us syndicated to airprogressive.org streaming web radio on Wednesday and Saturday mornings at 11. For more general availability, we're posted on nuclearhotseat.com/blog. We get linked to the Facebook Nuclear Hot Seat page and the Nuclear Hot Seat group page. And we're available on iTunes Podcast, where you can subscribe to us for free. And if you go to the new Facebook site and click on like, it will help Google recognize that we are here. This is Libby Halevi of Heartistry Communications, the heart of the art of communicating, reminding you that we've all had our nuclear wake-up call. Now, whatever you do, do not go back to sleep. Be safe, be well, and I'll speak with you again next week.